Good morning, everybody. Today, I want to speak to you about the joy that is God's pure love. So what is this? How do we approach this? What is the joy that is God's pure love? I thought about different things that I could talk to you about. I thought about the different aspects. But every time I brought it to God, he put one Bible book in my head. It was one that we're all familiar with, the book of Job. Now I immediately thought to myself, hang on now, Job, suffering. Job, problems. Job, difficulties. Where's the joy in Job? Today, that's what we're going to look at. We're going to look at what Job represents to us. Because I want to show you how the joy that is God's pure love is reflected in the book of Job, because Job typifies God's love that he showed us through Jesus Christ. So, there's the target. That's what we're aiming for today. So, if you turn with me to the book of Job, let's get a wee background information into this man. The first thing that we find out about is that Job lives in the land of Uz. Now, they tell me that the pronunciation for that is O-O-O-T-S. Uz. That's what I make that out of, but I can't figure out how U-Z could be Uz, but we'll not dispute that for too long. But I said, right, okay, well, where is it? Where was this happening? And so I decided to do a little bit of research, and the first thing I discovered was nobody knows. It's not recorded anywhere where this place was. There are a number of suggested places. Some say it's in Arabia. Others say, well, actually, it might be more towards Egypt. Some said it was Edom. But the point was, none of them could determine it. When did this book get written? Most scholars indicate that this could be one of the oldest books in the Bible, one of the first that was ever recorded. Now, others say Moses may have read it. He may have actually wrote this book and recorded it for us. So we don't know. It's not actually there. It's not defined. What we do know, however, is that judging by the age that Job lived, it had to be at a time of the patriarchs. The time of Abraham. That era. Because Job lived approximately over 200 years. And you can work this out just looking through the story itself. So there's a lot of things that we can find out about this man. Of course, it's important to mention that some believe that Job was not a real person. They think this might have been a parable. A simple story to explain what was going to happen, to explain the sufferings of man. However, it is generally accepted that it is based on a true story. So let's find out a bit about the man. He has a unique standing. Verse 1 tells us Job was blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. That's powerful stuff. Here we have a man who the Bible is declaring to be righteous. A man who seeks to do the will of God. A man who has everything. He has 7 sons, 3 daughters. He also in his possession has 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yokes of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household. He has become one of the most important and influential men in the Eastern world of his day. We know that his children were adults because they were already living in their own homes. They were already separating with their own families. And they would regularly feast together and share things because he had a concern. Job was concerned with the fact that perhaps when they were rejoicing, they might make mistakes. They might accidentally curse God, or worse. So every time these feasts had come to an end, Job would go and he would make a sacrifice. He would offer sacrifices on behalf of his children to cover their sins, to make allowance for them. This also tells us, of course, that if Job was in this particular function, he was using the role of a priest. But it was not Levitical priesthood, so it had to be prior to Moses. So, we know who Job is. We know that he is blessed of God. We know that he is highly respected. We know that he has honor and glory. But the best is yet to come. In verse 6 we read, "Now there is a day when the sons of God come to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them." Now that word Satan there simply means adversary. And if we examine that word, it simply means prosecutor, one who brings a charge against you. That's all it means. And we notice that Satan, when he comes, is not bringing the charge against God, he's bringing the charge against mankind. He continually does this. "And the Lord said to Satan, 'From where did you come?' So Satan answered the Lord and said to him, 'I'm from going to and fro in the earth, walking back and forth over it.'" Then God does something that we would find strange. God says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" I mean, the last thing we would really want God to do, isn't it, is to bring any of us to Satan's attention. Would you want your enemies to know all about you and how good you are? We'd consider that a bit of a red rag to a bull, wouldn't we? Yet God does this. He says to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" But he doesn't just leave it there. Oh, no, no. In verse 8 you can read on. "There's none like him. He's unique. He's a blameless, upright man who fears God and shuns evil." Can you imagine God saying that about us? I know, you can't take that too seriously. I mean, none of us could ever see God saying that about us. Could be honest. I know I couldn't. We don't fit into that criteria. But Job did. Job filled the criteria. Job was blameless. Job was upright. Job feared God. Job shunned evil. In fact, as we go through the book of Job, we find out a lot about his character, and he was a nice guy. Job could be depended on. Job was faithful. When you had a problem, you went to Job. When you had somebody that was persecuting you, or somebody had tried to cheat you in something, you went to Job. He sorted it out. He listened carefully. He took note of every aspect. He made a righteous decision, and nobody argued with it. Because he was righteous. Because he was a man who didn't do it out of his own motives. He was fair in all that he did. So you see, Job meets the criteria of someone that God could say to Satan, "Have you thought at him? Have you considered this is a righteous man?" Satan, of course, in verse 9 answers God, "Yes, all right, fair enough. He's good. Yeah, we understand that." But, you know, he doesn't do it because he actually really respects you. He does it because of what you've given him. There's something in it for Job. God says, "Do you think so? Oh, why? I mean, you consider all the things that have happened here. He's rich. He's powerful. He's got respect. Loving family. Did I mention he's rich? Satan brings this across same time again. It's because of what he has. It's because of what you've given him. You put a wall around him. He's protected. There's nothing to worry about. So God says, "Okay, tell you what, I'll take away the wall. I'll put him into your hands. I'll let you test him. But you're not to touch him. You're not to touch him at all. You know, when I read that, I can't help thinking how Satan must have jumped for joy. The opportunity had just been given. Here was his opportunity to prove, once and for all, that there is nobody on this earth who is willing to accept God because he's God. It's only for what they can get out of it. And he figured this has got to be the way it is. And now that God was no longer protecting Job, he didn't waste any time. We're told that he immediately, that same day, brought disaster upon Job. So what sort of disaster did he bring him to? How did he do this? I have in this wee bit of paper here some of the things wrote out for myself of what he did. But no, we'll go to the Bible, we'll do it that way. Verse 14. A servant came to Job. This was one of the days when his sons and daughters had met on a regular basis. This was one of the appointed days where they were celebrating. But a messenger comes to Job and says, the oxen were ploughing with the donkeys feeding beside them. Now you remember how many there was? There was 500 yoke of oxen and 500 female donkeys. So that's a lot of livestock. But notice what the oxen were doing, this 500 yoke of oxen. They were ploughing. They were actually working land. So, I mean, these were working oxen. These were not just grazing in the field. And that meant that for every yoke of oxen, you had to have a servant. So if you're talking 500 yoke, you had 500 servants for each of the yoke working them in the field. So when we read this and we find that the enemy has come down and took them all away, killing the servants with the edge of the sword, and this one individual is alone escaped. Job's just been told, you've just lost a great deal of riches. You've just lost 500 of your servants. They're gone. They're wiped out. They're finished. I alone am the only one left. They don't exist anymore. That was a bit of a blow. You know, Job had to step back a wee minute when he heard that. But then while he was still talking, another servant's coming running at him. Out of the blue. What's he want? Where's he going? This boy also is getting panicked. He says, I was with the camels, the sheep. Sorry, it was the sheep. And fire from heaven fell upon the flocks of sheep. 7,000 sheep. That's a big flock. Think how many shepherds it took to look after. 7,000 sheep. They weren't stolen. They were totally destroyed by fire from God. Do you know what that means? Do you know what fire coming from heaven and striking a city meant? Punishment. No doubt about it. For some reason, Job was being punished. There's no doubt about that in anybody's mind. Fire doesn't fall from heaven otherwise, especially when it hits only one man's property and wipes it all out. While he's still trying to get his way through that, somebody else comes. I'm up to the camels now, folks. And this man said, I've just escaped. I'm the only one to get away. All your camels and all your servants have been killed that looked after the camels, and all the camels have been taken away. 3,000 camels. Massive amount. So, as you can see, at this point, Job figures, there's a problem here. He knows they're not kidding him, because initially, that's what probably he would have thought. Right. Are you well in the head? Are you sure you're talking about the right person? Are you sure it's my land? No. He knew they're dead serious. This is what's happened to him. Everything has been stripped off him. But the worst is yet to come. Another servant. A servant that looks after the houses of the children. He says, we were all what your eldest son's house, your entire family. They were celebrating, eating and drinking wine as a part of the feast. We were doing all of this. When a great wind came, blew down the house over them, and every single one of them was dead. And all your servants that looked after them, everybody that cared for them, the big household in every one of their houses, all dead, except for me. I alone get to tell you. There could be no worse than that. Job separates himself, tore his robe, shaved his beard, part of the custom for mourning, fell on the ground, and worshipped. Think about that. This man had just received the most devastating of news. I mean, you hear bad things. You do. You, from time to time, you hear disaster upon disaster. But put yourself in Job's position for a moment. Would the first thing that would immediately come to your mind be to praise God, to worship God, to acknowledge God's supremacy in your life? Would that be the first thing that comes to your mind? I can tell you, vast majority of people, it wouldn't be. Yet that's what Job did. Naked came I into from my mother's womb. Naked shall I return there. The Lord give, the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And verse 22 here tells us exactly what God says about it all. In all of this, Job did not sin nor charge God with any wrongdoing. Job knew he hadn't done anything wrong. He hadn't done anything that he was aware that should have brought this penalty upon his life. And he also knew that God doesn't do anything wrong, so he didn't charge him against anything. He couldn't understand it. He couldn't explain it. It didn't make any sense to him. But he was willing to accept it at this point. He was willing to let it go. I didn't have anything at the start. And if God desires to take it all away, it's his to begin with. I'm only looking after it. It's only with me for as long as he allows it to be with me. It all belongs to God. Do we view things like that? I mean, do we think that everything that we have, our job, our family, our homes, our friends, our position in church, do we think those are ours? No. They're gifts from God. They're always his. So, if he decides to take them away from us, can we be like Job and say, okay, you're right, they're yours to begin with, you can take them back? Because that's how Job looked at it. We don't look at it like that. We don't think of it like that. Job literally worshipped God. But I said this was to reflect Jesus. When Jesus Christ came to this earth, he came, just as Job indicates here, naked from his mother's womb. He didn't have power and authority. He didn't have rights, riches. He came without anything. He gave up everything previously. He had been with God. He shared the title of God. He experienced glory beyond our imagination, of which he also indicates that he wanted God to return to him before he returned to the Father, which the Father said he would. So he acknowledged the fact that he had pre-existed. He acknowledged the fact that he had emptied himself of everything that was his. And he came without anything, no reserves, no riches, no individual power. When Jesus stood on this earth, he exercised the authority of a man who was obedient to God, a man who had not sinned. That was it. Jesus' power, authority, was that authority which comes originally had been given to Adam. Authority over the nature, authority over sickness, authority over disease. All of these things were given to men. But we lost it through sin. But because Jesus hadn't sinned, because he came from a source that was without sin, while fully man, he exercised that authority on our behalf. But he didn't exercise the authority of God. He didn't exercise the authority that he had with the Father. He exercised his authority as the Son. And that's the difference. So when we look at Job, we realize that before his true testing can come along, he has to be stripped of everything he had. He had to be willing to accept the fact that he would lose everything. Jesus, likewise, accepted the fact that he was starting with nothing. Everything that previously had existed, no longer there. If Jesus failed, it wouldn't be returned. If Jesus sinned, it was over. Sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we say, Jesus is God. He couldn't sin. But pointless. The whole point was he had to be tested as we are. The whole point was he had to come as we come. And he did. He had to be faithful. And that's what we're reminded with Job, because here was a man who was faithful. He tells us throughout the book of Job that when he was young, he had transgressions. So he wasn't perfect. But he says God didn't hold those transgressions against him. He had forgiven him. And therefore, one of his arguments was, the only thing you could possibly be bringing against me is the fact of my youth. That's not fair. If you've wiped me clean of it, why would you bring them things back? This was Job's argument. Jesus didn't even have that. No transgressions of a youth. It was totally different. Totally separate. But if we go back to the story of Job, he's now with nothing. He's got a wife. And he's got his health. People are still somewhat unsure as to what to make of it, but you know, he's still got his respect. People still say, well, no, he was a righteous man. He might have lost everything, but he was a righteous man. He didn't do anything wrong himself. Maybe his children sinned and God brought punishment on them. And maybe all that was taken away simply to remind him that he should have done something about his children. But he himself wasn't bad. He himself wasn't bad. So when the sons of God on another day come before God, Satan again is among them. This is chapter 2. God again says to Satan, where have you been? What have you been doing? So he tells him, I've been going back and forth over the earth, seeing what's happening. And God says to him, have you considered my servant Job? Now we'd think, hasn't Job had enough? Leave him alone. What's wrong with Job? Give him a break here. But no. God again says, have you considered him? Blameless, upright, a man who fears God, shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity. Though you enticed me to come against him and to destroy him without cause. So, God is holding Job up. He's holding him up as an example of perfection. He's saying, here's a man that's good. Here's a man that's doing right. Here's a man who hasn't turned against me, even though you told me to remove everything from him. He still worships me. He still honors me. He still does not commit sin before me. Satan says, we'll find it in verse 4 of Job 2, ask skin for skin. All that the man has is his life, and he'll give anything for his life. You haven't touched him. You never affected his body. You said I wasn't to touch him. If you had let me at him, he would have broke. He would curse you to your face, and there's nothing that would resist it. Okay. I put him into your hands. One thing, don't kill him. You do not have the right to execute him. Do you know, Satan didn't waste any time. Immediately, Job becomes covered with boils from the head to his sole to his feet. Every inch. And when we think of boils, we think of those sore things that come up, you know, suppurate and really, really painful. But there's an aspect to these boils that we have to take into consideration as well. The boils on Job attracted insects, flies. And because they were dying flesh, the insects laid their eggs in the boils. So Job's able to say that he is covered with maggots and flies. The stench of the dead flesh that was forming on him meant that nobody could come into his presence. He had to separate himself. We have somebody here who was abhorrent. Nobody wanted to be near him. This man wasn't subject to what his children had done. It wasn't a case of that his children had sinned. The world that was observing Job had changed their opinion. It was Job that must have sinned. Job, this righteous individual, must have done something terribly wrong, because this is a terrible, terrible thing that fell upon him. And we find that his wife, realizing the problems and seeing the pain he's in and all the rest, told him that he should curse God, die. So he's rejected by family. We find that he's no longer respected in the community. He's no longer able to come and address the people. His servants won't even look him in the eye. The female servants that would have looked after his needs, met his food and all the rest, done these different things, won't even come near him. People who he wouldn't have spent time on because they were worthless, they wouldn't even give them simple jobs of looking after his dogs. Their children were now calling him names, making fun of him. He was being rejected and despised by everyone. And he said, wanting to die. That's all he wanted to do. You can understand why Job wanted to die. Death would end it. He was totally disgraced. God, his hand was upon him, and he knew that no one else can do this. This only could be done through the authority of God. And Job understood that. He knew that Satan might be the instigator, the actual agent performing the deed. But Satan has no power, none, without permission from God. And Job understood that too. So he knew exactly what was going on. He understood the problem. So all he wanted to do was die, suffer death. Jesus began suffering the moment he'd stepped into this life. But we don't hear too much about him until he's 30 years old. He became baptized, and immediately the Spirit took him into the wilderness, where he began to be tempted. Look at the temptations of Jesus for a moment. They're very simple. Why don't you change the stones into bread? Do you know, from a human point, if we changed the stones into bread, we could feed the world's hunger overnight. We could sort out the problem. We could deal with sickness and disease on a mass scale. We could make people love us because we could take away their suffering and their strife and their problems. And that's exactly what Satan was showing to Jesus. Not just your own food, but you have the power to make a big difference here. You have a power to take control and bring universal peace. And you can do it simply by miracles, by feeding the poor, by healing the sick. You can do that. You know, we don't often look at it that way. We don't often think of it that way. But that's what Satan was doing. He was tempting Jesus with the possibility of doing it another way. Not having to go through the suffering servant route. Getting people to like you. Getting people to respect you. Getting people to need you. That's how one who is yet to come will inflict the world. He will meet their needs. He will do miracles. He will sort out their problems. People will say, who is like him? He's brilliant. And they'll worship him. So Satan knows exactly how it works. He's a growing plan for years. So what's he trying to do with Jesus? Second temptation, even more fun. Why don't you do a miraculous act? Do it at the temple where all the people can see you and know you're from God. Just throw yourself off. And the fact that you don't get killed will make a great difference. Do you know, the person that's coming, they think that's a good idea too. They receive a mortal wound. A wound that, for all intent and purpose, should kill them. But it doesn't. They're miraculously saved. Surely they must be protected by God. And the third temptation? If all else fails, if they don't accept us because we're willing to feed them and look after them and heal them, if they won't accept the fact that we can do miracles and do the wonder things, we can always just take them by force. What country in the world is going to fight against you if you have the power of God behind you? No. There's an enemy coming who has that exact same mindset. What he can't take through flattery, what he can't take through offering help to people, what he can't show through miracles, then he will take by the sword. He will enforce his will and make it happen. So Jesus went through the temptations, the desires, the problems. He was made aware of all these things. Sometimes we think it was very quick, you know. We get the impression when we're reading through it, well, surely it was only a few minutes. It was his thought, no, I'm rejecting that on the way on. For the full 3.5 years, Jesus was under temptation. Satan used every opportunity. He used Jesus' family. At one point, Jesus' family come to him and said, we think he's not well. Mark put it, they thought he wasn't right in the head. So they wanted to take him home. Yeah, this is Jesus we're talking about. This was Mary and the brothers and the sister. They wanted to take Jesus home because they thought he had gone a little crazy. Do you think people thought Job, when he was going through things and was praising God and said, it's all right, God's in charge, God's looking after it, they thought he was crazy? His wife was telling them, you'd be safer just cursing God and die. Stop this relationship. Get away from it. And that's what was happening. This is what's going on. As we read the book of Job, as we look at Job, we are getting a picture of what Jesus went through. His friends. Ah, his friends. We all know about Job's friends, don't we? Job's friends. Well, there's a proverb, isn't there? Don't be like Job's comforters. Everybody knows what it means. Instead of helping him, they accused him. They told him, look, here's the evidence. Very simple evidence. We know what God does. You fall into the pattern of what just has happened, so therefore you had to have sinned. End of story. They weren't willing to accept the fact of all the good he had done before. They weren't willing to accept, even though they initially acknowledged it. They initially acknowledged, yes, we know that the poor praise your name. We know that the fatherless praises you. We know that you are the one who fights for the injustice. We know that you do all of these things and that no man has starved in your place. You give out your bread and you've met people and you've clothed them and you've done all these things. We know all that. But the evidence speaks, if you are going to be persecuted like this here, you must have done something wrong. Did Jesus experience that sort of persecution? Yes, he did. He healed people. He met their needs. And yet the people told him, something not right about this. Can't be purposeful. It has to be through Satan. Maybe he's doing it for you. Jesus was very angry with them when he told them that, because he told them, look, all right, you might not be able to accept me. You might not be like the fact that I'm a Galilean. You might not like the fact that I'm from the house of Judah. You might not like a lot of things. But there's one thing you have to accept. The work that I'm doing can't be done by Satan. Can only be done by God. Therefore, accept even only the works. If you don't want me, that's fine, but accept the works. Job had done all these works, and they were suddenly forgot about it. What important? Obviously, you've done something wrong. You know, when Jesus was on the cross, the thing that between Job and Jesus, the one thing that is so ties them together, is that both of them had one viewpoint. And that was, the one thing that they missed the most was their relationship with God. If you read through the story of Job, with all that happened to him, the one thing that was most important to him was he wanted God to vindicate him. He wanted God to talk to him. He wanted God to explain what was going on. It was his lack or loss of relationship with God that was striking and driving him. That was the whole point of the story. He couldn't understand what was going on. On the cross, Jesus experienced that too. Father, why have you deserted me? Where have you gone? This in my hour of need, this time when I need you most, you've disappeared. You've gone. I'm alone. He couldn't understand it. So, time's beating me, folks. But I want you to understand that the book of Job isn't just a story or a parable of the past that tells us about suffering. It's a mirror that we can reflect the full suffering of Jesus in. And while Job failed, for he did fail, Jesus didn't. And it was Job who recalls, my Redeemer lives and he walks on the earth. And he does. Jesus Christ is alive. He lives. He's our Redeemer. And he walks on the earth. Even now, in each and every single one of you, Jesus Christ is our Redeemer, the suffering servant.